there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Welcome to Words to Write By.
Welcome, dear listeners.
So just to highlight one of the things we've been doing recently, we're reading a process book right now, Anne Lamont's Bird by Bird, and we decided to accompany this, we would do a process group. How's that working out, Renee?
Oh my gosh, it's great. Oh, everyone's so great. I love it. And you can find our process group on Meetup. You just go to our website and you click the link on there and it'll take you to the Meetup page and it's totally free. Yeah, we've met some really cool people.
The cool thing about process group, it's not just us saying, oh, here's how you should do these things. It's like everybody contributes. And one person says, I have this problem. Other person says, oh, I solved it this way. And one of the most common ones you get is like, well, I just can't get myself concentrated on writing. And that's when I pull out there's this Meetup group called Shut Up and Write. And I say this thing, and then one person says, yes, and I host Shut Up and Writes in Australia, and I host. And it's like, oh, yeah, half of the people knew about it, and half the people are like, wow, that sounds really good.
Yeah, so if you've been kind of lonely, you know, writing by yourself, and you don't really have a writer's community, this is a great way to dip your toe into the writing community and meeting new writers and getting to see what they have to say. And like Kim said, we're not sitting there giving you advice. We're kind of going around, and we're chatting it up and talking about issues that writers are having, and people chime in and try to help you out.
Yeah. So we're meeting every other week on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific Coast time in California. You can find the link on our website.
Yeah. Someone in Australia did.
Yep. Okay. So in our previous episode, we went pretty in depth on the idea of character-driven novels versus plot-driven novels. Renee and I both have very different approaches to how we start a novel, what we started with characters, what we start with plot. And we were thinking that a lot of Lamont's advice has to do with the fact that she's reaching out to people to do more literary writing as opposed to genre writing. And so I contacted some genre writers and got a feel for how they do it.
My name is Laura C. Stevenson. I have written 8 books. The most recent one is All Men, Glad and Wise, which is a mystery.
When people think about mysteries, we usually think about their plots. How do you start your novels? With characters or with plots?
First of all, I think people are wrong to think about mysteries in terms of plot instead of characters, because the plot, at least of a standard Agatha Christie murder mystery, is sort of carved in stone. There is a murder. It's in a nice place where you wouldn't expect the murder to happen. And then enter the detective. And this is where the character comes in.
Could you give an example from one of your novels of how the characters drive the plot?
Okay. I started with a character who's going to get into the mystery. She's going to be my detective, right? Her name is Harry. She has been acting as a boy all her life, but now she's 14 and that has to come to an end. Her father is the stable groom of a very fancy stable. It's 1919 and cars are now replacing horses. And she and her father are going to be out of a job. She is riding back from delivering a message and her horse throws her. And she finds out in the woods, it's been hit by something. She rushes into the woods to find out what has happened. And there is the murder victim. She decides to solve the mystery.
So when you started the story, were you thinking about this girl
and her family situation and her coming upon the murder victim? Or did you start with something more personal about who she was?
I started with more personal than who she was. I had had her in mind for another book and no, she didn't fit. So I put her in this one.
And how did knowing her so well cause you to choose how to write the plot of the book?
It just sort of happens. As the book progressed, more and more of her character began to emerge. But it's a mystery, so you have to keep the plot going or your readers leave you.
Did you know who the murderer was and how the story would resolve itself when you began writing the book?
I had to figure it out. I kept introducing characters, see? And about page 150, I thought, you know, I really have to decide which one of these characters did it.
When you did come up with who the murderer was, did you have to change their character at all by going back in the story, or was everything there just to keep going?
Oh, no, no. I go back and forth all the time. I had to go back and change that and then change some other relationships, right? And then so I had to go back to that. I'm the kind of writer who outlines after writing. So you get it to a certain point and you think, uh-oh, I'd better outline this just to see if it's going along. And you look at it, you think, yikes, it doesn't. So then you fix it. Some of this involves going back. Some of it involves inventing a backstory, which you didn't know. It takes a long time.
Hi, everyone. My name is Leah Riley, and I write romantic commercial fiction. And one of my books is Upside Down, and it is the first book in the Off the Map trilogy.
When you start a book, do you start it with the idea of the characters, or you just start it with the idea of the plot?
I tend to start with a character. So I generally get a character in my head and I get curious about that character. And then I start to build a story around them as opposed to going into the plot first, for better or worse.
Now with romance, it's always about two people. So do you start off with two characters or do you start off with somebody then you find their perfect or not so perfect mate?
For conventional romance, it's generally a relationship between two people. If I can like speak to it a little bit, what I'd say the thrust of like the majority of romance is a character journey, moving two people from a place of like their identity or the mask that they're looking to show the world. Essentially, what have they created as armor around themselves to hide their vulnerabilities, to hide their character hurts, etc. And through the process of engaging and falling in love and connecting, they end up becoming more their authentic whole selves by the end of the book. And so I would say that you have this like big internal shift that happens between the characters.
And that has to be pushed along by the plot. So how do you introduce the plot, given that you have your characters to start with?
Great question. First, I want to talk a little bit about trope. So tropes play quite a lot in commercial fiction. In romance, I would say that readers are generally picking up the book looking for certain emotional experiences. And there tends to be certain tropes that readers like. And they're all individual. Like everyone kind of has like their own thing they love. So some people love a good enemies to lovers story of like two people who are showing like their worst selves and then move into like connection. Some people love to have fated mates and they've just been like connected through certain universal circumstances. Some people love things like a second chance at love. And so trying to think about what's the trope that you want to deliver in that story. And I think a lot of authors have like their favorite tropes that they like to work with. And then within that trope, then you have to think of the plot. What would the core conflict start to look like that's going to let the reader have the emotional experience they're signing onto with the trope that they are wanting to get? So if it's like a Beauty and the Beast type story, what's going to be a really good plot that is going to kind of like help anchor that sort of a trope? That's how I do it. I mean, everyone probably has their own special way, but I think that kind of logically makes sense.
Do you work with the same tropes again and again, or is it a different trope for each story?
I've got favorites, but I certainly will play around with different tropes. I love a Beauty and the Beast. I love like a Grumpy Sunshine type of vibe. Those are always stories I really like. And often good romances are going to have a couple tropes. You generally don't have like a trope, but you may have like Grumpy Sunshine. So like somebody who's more sullen or stern and someone who's more effervescent, then you could layer that in with like a forced proximity. So let's say there's like a snowstorm and they're stuck together into a cabin. And then you can have like a fish out of water trope layered onto that. I mean, I'm going very Hallmark movie here, but like one of them's from the big city and they don't know what it's like to be in the country. So you tend to kind of like layer on a few tropes as well.
So it's like character and then trope and then the plot that makes it all go along.
That's what I do. Other people might say, I'm going to start first with trope and then figure out what characters are going to fit my trope. Some people might say I've got a really good high concept hook, but for me, that's what I tend to do.
Hi, everyone. I'm Stuart Jaffe. I'm a paranormal mystery and urban fantasy author, best known for the Max Porter Paranormal Mysteries, which begins with the book Southern Bound.
Let's start with the first book from that series, back before you had all the characters developed. When you were writing that book, what came first, the characters or the plot?
I can't actually answer the question you just asked because I wrote that book over a decade ago. I don't know. I know the kernel of the story. This whole plot versus character thing is like a fallacy. It's all about story. And they both drive the story equally. And so, yes, some books of mine, the kernel is going to be a character who I want to play with. And in other books, it might be a plot. But ultimately, you're going to have to feed both the mouths, both the plot mouth and the character mouth. Or generally speaking, other than a few outliers, your story is going to fall apart and not work.
You start with one thing, but then you're going back and forth and back and forth so much that they might as well be writing them both at the same time.
Yes, it's something we have to train ourselves to do, but we kind of do anyway. If you start your story with a character and you think about this character, ultimately what you're thinking about is what can I make that character do, right? And you start developing a story, and then the plot is just the path which we tell that story with. Or if you start with a plot, it's really a story idea that you're starting with. And you're trying to figure out how to tell that story. And in doing so, you have to create a character. Otherwise, you're not telling a story about anything, just locations. You always have to do both. It's kind of like the whole plotting versus pantsing thing. Everybody does both of them. It's just a matter of at what time in the process you're going to do them. That's it.
And when you're going back and forth, do you mentally separate it when you're working, or is it all together?
Now it's all together. I've been writing for over 20 years now, and I have over 50 some books out there. So now a lot of it is muscle memory. I was certainly much more conscious of it when I was learning to write and working at it. I do plot my books. So even after I'm finished with the plotting, there's got to be a character arc. That's how you can figure out the beats of your plot. Otherwise, again, you're just putting in locations and making things happen for no reason. The plot has to affect the character to make the character arc happen, and the character arc defines what the plot needs to be. So they both feed each other. I guess it kind of has to develop simultaneously, or a little bit of back, almost like a tennis match. And the story is the ball, I guess.
Not a bad metaphor. Well, thank you so much. This is really cool. I think there's a lot of good information in what you just said.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you so much. Great interviews.
Thank you guys so much for taking your time to be interviewed. We've had a really good time.
And you can get their bios on our website.
Yes.
The three authors.
And links to their books.
Okay.
So next chapters of Bird by Bird.
So we've gone from plotting to dialogue. So now we're on to set design and false starts.
These aren't super chunky chapters.
These aren't very meaty. Mm-hmm. No, they're not like full meals of chapters, like little snacks.
Yeah. So tell us what's in set design.
All right. Set design should pretty much be called setting, right?
Yeah, it just sounds better.
Right. And, you know, she's got some good nuggets in here. Just as everyone is walking advertisement for who he or she is, so every room in your novel is a little showcase of its occupants, values, and personalities. Every room is about memory. This is about setting, but the whole thing pretty much just talks about her interviewing people to get the setting right and getting to know characters, who they are, how they are professionally, and that's it.
So let's go back a little bit to the idea about the rooms. Oh, one thing I got out of that was every room is a memory, is that I then looked around my own room and realized how much damn clutter I have. How many things I haven't picked up? How many things like were just purely random? And the fact is that most rooms actually probably read a lot about one's psychology. Like, are you a neat person? Are you somebody that is very curated? Are you somebody that just kind of throws stuff together? Are you somebody that hasn't picked up their clothing in the last month? I think that there's a psychological element to a room, but what she's talking a little bit more is a memories, like using a room to really
Like, she has these perfectly curated rooms.
Okay, maybe we should just go straight to that quote then.
Okay.
Every room is about memory. Every room gives us layers of information about our past and present and who we are. Our shrines and quirks and hopes and sorrows. Our attempts to prove that we exist and are more or less okay. You can see in our rooms how much light we need, how much light bulbs, candles, skylights we have, and how we keep things lit. You can see how we try to comfort ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
How a person keeps their room or their house says a lot about their character.
Yeah, but I think as an author writing about a person, we don't have to have our characters be slobs.
But if you do, it's okay.
Yeah, it is. But like, this goes back to an idea that is often related, that you show a person's emotional mood through the stuff around them, through the external situation. And here, a room is sort of showing a person's, it's showing the character of the person through the room.
Well, I have an idea here.
Okay.
Here's a way to illustrate it, I think. So I'm at your house right now, Cam.
Yeah.
And if I were a reader and you were the protagonist in the story and the writer described your living room or your kitchen, right? I, as the reader, would be able to glean certain things from you. For example, you have small counters, right? But there's lots of stuff on them. But it's not messy.
Really?
Well, I don't think it's messy. I see everything that's there, and most of it's edible, and most of it's fresh. I would eat it or drink it. But what also is awesome that I really enjoy is that you've got your kids' creations on the wall. And you have this semi-permanent structure for you to swap them out.
Yeah, which is empty because we haven't swapped them out since Christmas and we haven't put up the new stuff. But
the fact that it's there means that you're continually featuring your kids' stuff and they are expected to share their stuff. And it's like the biggest wall in the house. What I'm trying to say is that you are a family person and it's good.
Actually, here's the point I was making. There's a difference between the subconscious stuff we do with the clutter and stuff like that and then the conscious stuff that we do. Like in this room, I have my assembled Lego Voltron. And that says something about me that I want to say to other people coming in and seeing me. Room is not just a private psychological example of your character, but also what they want to showcase to the world.
Right. There's a textbook I used to teach in my composition class called Everything's an Argument. And in the beginning, the chapter talks about how somebody dresses is an argument.
Mm.
They're arguing like their personality or what they are choosing to share with people as they walk, as they dress, what car they drive, all of these things is an argument
mm-hmm.
to get some point across.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Kim, what argument am I giving off right now?
You put on clothes in the morning?
I did. I am wearing a bra, dear listener. I actually got dressed, but like I've got classic Renee style geek shirt. It says too long, don't read rainbow. And it's got the reading rainbow. One of my favorite shirts, right? I'm also covered in cat hair from Kim's cat. And I've got jeans. So what argument am I giving off, Kim? It's okay. You don't have to be nice.
Well, you're giving off a very low key argument. Like you're just chill.
Yeah, I'm chill. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm not wearing any makeup. I clearly didn't do my hair. So all of these things, like I'm in Kim's closet right now, and it's clear that she goes to the ocean because there's wetsuits in the background.
Yeah, but they're dry wetsuits. They haven't been taken out in over 6 months. What I'm saying here is there's two elements here. There's the psychological, personal things, like the cat hair, because, you know, a cat jumped on you, you love cats. And then there are the decisions you make, like what your t-shirt says, what snarky t-shirt you're wearing around. And these rooms, I always think of them as serving a psychological
example, like what gets get into the person that lives here and what kind of person lives there. Whereas some of these other things, these performances are what does our character want the world to see about them?
Right. So some of it is intentional and some of it is unintentional.
Yeah.
Some of it reveals things under the surface that they don't even see.
Some of the things are what we, the author, want to reveal about the character, and some of the things are what the character wants to reveal about the character.
I feel like this book, like the other books we've read, around the halfway point starts giving us diminishing returns. And these two chapters feel like that. So this set design one, she talks about interviewing people. So say you've got a character protagonist who might be very well off and very rich. She suggests you call up your really rich aunt and ask them kind of what their life is like so that you can get insights and learn about your character so that they become more real in the book.
But there's another element. I think this is one of the things where there's like a surface reading and a closer reading. The other thing that she says in this line is that you have to be tactful. By tactfully, I mean that you're going to get the best possible information if you do not mention life's unfairness and that your own house looks more like God's little acre with every passing day and that you may have to put the dog to sleep because you can't afford to feed her. And this is actually a really good bit of advice. When you are going out and seeking information, listen. Don't tell your interview subjects what you want to hear. Don't impose your own will. Just go there and be open and not to push your own judgments on them.
That's good to know because my background's not in this. Yours is interviewing. I mean, Kim does the interviews, right? You do really good interviews. I guess now I will start listening to that. I will start listening to more what the questions you ask to get the most out of them, to get them speaking more.
Yeah, and I edit, so you can't necessarily hear all those details. But that is a really important thing, I think, that she brings up in this that you interview. And then the other example she has here is she uses the whole business of her writing a story about gardening, and she can't garden to save her life. So she goes to a garden store and finds somebody, and she asks them information because she wants to include a garden in her book. The reason why she wanted to do it is because gardens have such great metaphors. Metaphors are a great language tool because they explain the unknown in terms of the known. And I think a lot of us like to use metaphors, but she was saying here that she could have just gone for the metaphors. She knew all the metaphors she wanted the garden to have. What she didn't know was what plants were blooming at what time and what kind of caring you had to give for fruit trees and all those other details. And that's what she went and got the expert for and used those to inform her metaphors.
Right, because she says those metaphors only work if they resonate in the heart of the writer. She had to put it in her heart.
I had a friend who was writing a book, and at a certain point, she has her characters all up in a redwood forest, and she has extensive background in floral arrangements and in working in a flower shop. And so she just put all these wonderful flowers, and I'm reading it, and I'm saying, that's great, but you know, those flowers don't grow up in the redwoods. So she had to step back and she had to actually figure out what plants would actually be in a redwood forest. And they were different than the ones you sell in the store.
All right. I guess I was being a little harsh. It seems like weird advice to me. I don't know if I would ever interview somebody to write a character. And then I just realized I did that very thing. I'm getting old, dear listener, but I have this memory of writing a poem. I didn't even know why I wanted to write it, but I just wanted to write it. And I needed to know how a gun worked. My boyfriend at the time, now he's my ex, his mother didn't let him play with war toys. So he made them himself and hid them. And I thought there was something really interesting about that. No matter what her efforts were, she still couldn't get him to stop. And he knew he wasn't supposed to, but he had this compulsion to get it anyway. But he said he made his own like guns. And I said, well, what are the parts of a gun? And I wanted to describe that whole process. So I had to interview him, like, okay, what does this do? And I had to get all the details right so that I didn't say something dumb and say the trigger goes in the wrong place or whatever.
Or call it by the wrong name.
Call it by the wrong name. So I guess I have actually done this. I think what is annoying me about this chapter is that most of it is just meandering. It reads like a free write of her talking about how she's not a very good gardener.
There's an awful lot about how she's not a very good gardener.
And I mean, like, I get it. She's trying to illustrate without telling us what she means so that we get a better understanding. But she goes on and on a lot for something that she sums up. There's two sentences in the final paragraph that sums up this entire chapter. And she says, I have asked all sorts of people to help me design sets. Okay? And then she says, I tried to imagine the movie set of this scene in as much detail as possible. And that is set design.
That is set design.
That's it. I don't know. Do you think I'm being too harsh?
I think that it is a really good chapter if someone hasn't done that kind of writing. But you are right. It's pretty straightforward what you need to do. And it's pretty straightforward that you need to interview people to get this information. I mean, now with Google, you can do certain things. But you know, I wouldn't trust ChatGPT to tell me about when to plant my flowers.
Right.
It's good to have an actual human.
Okay. So it's called set design. It's not called setting. And it's interesting because it focuses mostly on the person and their relationship with their environment, not just their environment separated from the character.
Mm-hmm.
So she wanted to know about gardening. She went and talked to a gardener. She didn't just get a book.
Right.
To read about how gardens work.
Mm-hmm. She basically sucks off somebody else's passion and somebody else's insight to give to her characters so that people think that she actually knows this stuff.
Right. Or that their character knows this stuff.
Well, no, but the people that read her books think she's a fantastic gardener because of this book.
Oh, right.
Because she absorbed that gardener's passion, that gardener's insight, and probably some of the gardener's lines. So I also had a quote one time from a journalism teacher, and his comment is that you don't interview someone for information. You interview them for quotes.
Mm.
And I don't think that's completely true because, like, when I'm doing science writing, I actually do need to know what the scientist was thinking, and there's stuff in the paper that doesn't quite make sense, so I do go for information. But part of the reason why she's going out and talking to these people is she is absorbing their best lines, and she uses them, and she's being honest here.
Interesting. That's good to know. I didn't catch that, but I think I can see it now.
I kind of got as we were discussing, like, oh, yeah, that's what she was talking about.
By the way, have you ever interviewed somebody to get information for, like, you writing your, like, your novel?
No, I haven't been quite gutsy enough to do it yet.
Okay.
Because, like, part of me is, like, I can interview for a story because I want to write the such and such story, so I need to talk to you. But to say, I'm writing a book about such and such, I'd like to sit you down and talk to you about it. I do know that one point I said that I wanted to go out and talk to a tattoo artist to talk about tattoos, and you told me not to.
Oh, I did?
Yeah.
Sorry.
You said they'd be weirded out if you came and talked to them.
Oh, they might. But didn't I like, give you all this information?
Actually, you know what? I interviewed you about tattoos.
I think you did,
yes. I did. I learned a lot when I interviewed you about tattoos.
Did you actually end up interviewing a tattoo artist?
No, I never did. Oh, I just used your information.
I had the information. Yeah. Okay. I have lots of tattoos, dear listener. Okay, cool. So I guess we have both done it. We both were successful at it. Both of us have different feelings about that chapter. False starts.
So I didn't get as much out of this chapter. Did you get something out of this chapter?
I did. Why didn't you like it? Because I started my little rant on the last one. So you start your rant on this one.
So the idea in False Starts is that she gives a metaphor of a painter painting and then whiting out everything and repainting and whiting out everything because they haven't gotten what they want. And they just have to clear the thing and start over again. And I was wondering how that squares with the shitty first drafts concept where you write everything and then you find the good stuff and pull it out. So I found an inconsistency in this chapter and it felt like she was trying to have both ways.
That's a really good point. I didn't think of the shitty first drafts. But what I like about this chapter is this is how I write. Maybe this is why it's so hard for me to get that shitty first draft out. This is the process. She illustrates the process of how my brain works and put things together. But there's so much unknown in it. That painter repainting stuff, he's not a happy painter. There's nothing
at the end
pleasurable
of the,
about
that
process.
Because at the end of the day, they got a white canvas. Like, what the fuck?
Right. They're never going to be happy. You just keep repainting it. Eventually, though, you give in and you find something. And that's what she did. she found a metaphor that it took a bunch of writing to get to it. And you didn't know it was going to happen until you got there. You just keep going like Dory. Just keep swimming.
Just keep swimming. I mean, I guess it gives you hope. You are doing something in your brain when you're waiting this out, and you are getting closer to what you are looking for.
Right. Like the last chapter in set design, she talks about character and environment. In this one, she pretty much focuses on character. She talks about how you like don't really know who your character is until you finish a first draft. And by the end of the first draft, then you're like, there's my character. I understand them now, which is how you have to go back and erase a bunch of stuff.
And I thoroughly of the opinion that my original openings for stuff are just placeholders in order to get to the action and discover who the characters are and come back and rework it.
Well, that's a false start.
So I do have false starts. And most of my books, I stop writing around, like, you know, 20, 30,000 words, and I go back and I redo it because I feel like I can't build a story off of that original stuff that was wrong. I need to get that stuff right to really launch everything else. I agree with her approach. I just kind of got ticked off that it seemed like it was counter to what the other thing is.
Yeah, it is a little bit. I think maybe this is just part of the process of the shitty first draft. You're going to have false starts. And part of the shitty first draft is going to be writing a bunch of stuff about a character that you're not going to use because you're just getting to know them and you don't really know them yet. I don't know. I actually had a question of whether you've had an experience with this. Like, have you stumbled upon something? For example, in this chapter, False Starts, she talks about how she goes to old folks' homes and she thinks she's got them pegged. She's like, oh, they're just old people. They forget me all the time, you know, whatever. They're kind of like cliches, right? But the more she goes, the more she gets to know them and the more they become alive. They become more like people and not just a cliche of an old person.
Just, you know, I don't think this was like part of her writing process. I think it just goes here and this is something that's part of her life. And she's just using it as a metaphor. Like she's not writing stories about these old people.
No, she's not. But she does illustrate how she comes up with a metaphor for them if she was writing about them. Mm-hmm. So she went outside the old folks' home. Like she went outside just to take a break and she saw a branch or like a tree. It looked like a dead tree, I guess, but it was like just tree in winter where it's like there's no leaves. And then she's reminded of a painting. And even though these old people are no longer useful in any traditional meaning of the word, they are there to be loved unconditionally, like trees in the winter. And so by going through that whole experience, it took the end. It took till going outside and seeing something completely unrelated for her to understand the purpose of her visits and the purpose of going and meeting people that just forget you every single time and just gum their tapioca.
Another way of looking at this is that you put all this effort into your false starts, into doing these things, and then finally at some point, something's going to click. Everything you worked on is going to fit, and it's going to unfurl properly. And she had to have all that time with the old people and thinking about it, churning over it. And at a certain point, just the right thing comes, and then it's lovely. It's a bit of hope, right? You know, yes, you've tried writing the story three times, but you know, and you're going to go out a fourth time and you don't feel like you have anything else, but maybe, just maybe, it'll click.
Right. And so if you have not read this book, dear listener, or you've just skimmed it, this is her style. Like she meanders, she goes into these like anecdotal stories for paragraphs. And sometimes you're just like, what the hell? Who cares?
How is this going to help me sell my novel?
Right. And sometimes the plane lands in a really good spot. And you're like, oh, that's great. And sometimes you're like, what kind of shitty airport is this? It didn't get anything out of it. So it's funny because you got something out of the previous chapter and I got something out of this one. Specifically, this very thing has happened to me. And that's some of my best chapters. Has this ever happened where you're like writing and then it just clicks? And something you hadn't seen before after like the 50th revision, you're like, oh,
I've never gotten 50 revisions on anything, Renee.
Okay, I was over-exaggerating the number here. You've been revising and revising.
Right, but I don't think I revise nearly as much as you do.
Okay, I might have an OCD tendency, and not in the good way. Not in the, I'm clean, that's not me. So this did happen to me, this piece. Our friend Chris really likes this piece. I've read it at open mics. And it's about my dad. He was living in a trailer park, and I fell. It's the 80s, dear listener. There were no babysitters back then. And I'm riding my bike, and I fell into a ditch, and I was covered in blood. And this lady came and saved me. I was like 8. She saw me there. She picked me up. My face is all covered in blood and took me to my dad's trailer. And dad just cleaned me up. I actually needed stitches. But hey, whatever. They didn't have stitches back then in the 80s. And so I wrote about it, and it seemed almost like a pity party thing. Like, look how shitty my dad was. But it's like, that's not really that interesting. There's plenty of shitty dads out there. But I wrote about it. And then about a year later, I came back to it. You know, I went through my old stuff and I was like, well, I'll just keep reworking it. And I started reworking it. And the next day, for some reason, I just got really into it and I hit on it. I saw two things that seemed almost unrelated, and they came together, and it was like, and I thought about his experience in Vietnam. I'm not trying to make excuses for him, but, you know, his experiences in Vietnam, and he's getting shot, and he did all these crazy, like, death-defying things, almost like he wanted to die. I was like, dude, you volunteered for Vietnam when you were 17. Why? He had to get his dad's signature. Like, why would you offer yourself up like a lamb to the slaughter? You know, he didn't even get drafted. And he volunteered for like the river rat, like the one of the most dangerous jobs in Vietnam. And these two things came together. I was like, wait a minute. I see something now. He's always playing with death. And I realized that they were friends. Him and death are friends, man. And then in the chapter, I talked about how death was my godparent. Like, they're so buddy-buddy that he just let him babysit me.
And it just came, it was a false start the first time, and then it clicked.
Multiple years. I wrote it, I worked with it, nothing happened with it. A year later, I came back to it, and it was just like, it still doesn't feel right. And then at the point where it had been a year later, a couple days had passed after I unearthed it again, and then I went, oh. And it's interesting because it didn't just hit me. It was something I wrote my way into. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, this is magical. Like, it came. I thought it was really good.
I will say that even more satisfying than to write something that just comes out perfect is to take something that wasn't quite there and then to make it into something great. Because then you know it's really your writing chops. It's not just the incident itself. It required something of you to make it good.
Right. I had to work for it. That's the thing I tell my students is I don't want to read somebody's first attempt at a poem. That's insulting. I want to read your 20th attempt. That's going to be way better. But your first attempt, I don't want first attempt writing. Who wants to read that? All right.
Right. Okay. So I think this was a pretty interesting conversation. I'm going to say let's end it here. And
okay. So if you've been following us for quite a while, usually we do a activity. I would say we got lazy, but we did not get lazy. I swear. We've been writing and we got busy and birthdays were had and other things have happened. So please forgive us this week.
It's good. We have a whole bunch of great stuff going on, but it's taken up a lot of time. So we're trying to streamline these episodes a bit more.
Yeah. So, but next time, we swear, there will totally be an activity. And not only that, but I can guarantee it's going to be a big one.
Oh, you got an idea for one?
Well, no. I mean, I've read ahead and there's some big stuff happening.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it with that before we go. Thank you guys so much for listening. And Renee, tell them how they can support our podcast.
Well, it just so happens that we have a Patreon account. Did you know that, dear listener? Probably. So we have a Patreon account. It's pretty cool. You get bonus episodes. You get some chapter notes. And you can join our community if you want. We also have a process group that meets every other week. It comes out the other week of our podcast, and you can access that on our website. Just go to our website. There's a little poster. It's on meetup.com. Hope to see you there.
And as always, reviews on Apple Podcasts are always appreciated. So if you could listen to this podcast, especially if you listen to it on Apple Podcasts, if at the end of this, if you're still listening, could you just click on the rating or click on give us a quick review? We'd really appreciate that.
Okay. And share it with a friend.
Yes, absolutely. And share our process group with a friend. Okay. You guys take care, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Auf Wiederhorn.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
I thought I had a very smart insight on this, and now it's slightly going away from my head.